Elizabeth Bentley. In her lengthy confession to the FBI, she had disclosed her role as courier making pickups from a chemist, a man who ran the Chemergy Design Corporation in Philadelphia, Abe Brothman. Bob completed Van Loon's thought. "So you think Brothman could be Raymond?" "Perhaps," his friend concurred. And he had more. Another suspect. The grand jury that followed up on Bentley's accusations had brought Brothman in to testify. The chemist got on the stand and, as Van Loon judged the story, lied through his teeth. He claimed he'd only given Bentley and her control, Jacob Golos, information that was harmless, industrial processes that were public knowledge. He had no idea either Bentley or Golos was working for the KGB. In fact, they came to his company with sterling recommendations. Harry Gold, a chemist and one of his valued associates, had made the introduction. When Gold appeared in front of the grand jury, he too pleaded ignorance. He'd believed Golos was a legitimate businessman, and now was shocked to learn differently. It had been Brothman's and Gold's sworn testimony against that of an admitted communist spy whose reputation was further sullied by her characterization in the leering press as a loose woman. The grand jury decided to believe the two chemists, and the FBI washed its hands of the whole matter. But as Bob listened to Van Loon resurrect all this recent history, he came around to thinking there might be something there. And not for the first time, he had a premonition that the loose ends of his past investigations were reaching into his present inquiry. With resolve, as well as considerable trepidation, he wrote up a memo for the fifth floor. With so much at stake, he posited, the Bureau must throw aside restraint, as well as the law. He wanted the hierarchy to authorize a black bag job. The target? Brothman's Chemergy Design Corporation. Hoover agreed. The burglars were in and out without attracting attention. And when their booty was examined, it was clear that they'd brought back a prize, a typewritten document which referred to the industrial application of a process of thermal diffusion. Bob read the pages. And when he was done, he was convinced he had just been studying a KGB courier's summary of the classified paper Rest had provided on gaseous diffusion. Either Brothman or Gold, he felt satisfied, was Raymond. But as the Philadelphia office began its digging into the two chemists and their local company, the full glare of their suspicions quickly shone on Gold. Many of the details the agents were able to obtain about Gold's life and travels fit in with the nuggets about Raymond gleaned from Fuchs's confession, Bob crowed, ready to open a celebratory bottle of champagne. What clinched the match was that Gold looked the part. The shortish, balding chemist, with a body shaped like a bowling pin, was nearly the spitting image of the descriptions offered by both Fuchs and the Heinemanns. He had to be Raymond. With great expectations, Gold's photo was presented to Fuchs. The scientist looked at it quizzically. Then he shook his head dismissively. "This is not the man," he snapped. This was the baggage, a heavy load of frustrations, dead ends, and anxieties that Bob carried with him as he walked off the plane in London on that May morning. John Simperman, the Bureau's man based at the American Embassy, was there to escort Bob and Clegg to MI5 headquarters. As the embassy car drove through the surprisingly cold and dreary city, Bob looked out into the streets and was shocked by what he saw. It was 5 years since the war had ended, but the effects of the German air raids remained. The rows of smashed buildings lining the pavement like cadavers, the rubble scattered about the street. It all left him feeling as if the war was still on. With that disheartening thought, his whole mood began to be transformed. It brought him around to reminding himself that a war, in fact, still raged. But in this cold war, the spies and the spy hunters were the soldiers. And now, closer to his prey, he shrugged off all that had been weighing on him. With a renewed commitment to his mission, he continued on through the city. He remained silent, pretending to sleep, but it was the quiet of resolve. Bob now looked forward to the challenge. He considered the opportunity to interrogate Klaus Fuchs, one of the great opportunities of my life. 29. Flanking the sturdy front gate of Wormwood Scrubs Prison in Hammersmith, on the outskirts of London, were two dark towers that tapered as they rose, evoking bishops on a chessboard. Each was decorated with a relief depicting a Victorian-era prison reformer, and when Bob was informed of this curious fact, he could not help but think the tribute was all irony. "Abandon all hope, ye who enter here," he could almost hear the guard solemnly intoning each time the gate swung open, and he passed beyond the tall prison walls and into the dank fortress. He had first arrived at the prison. Dreary, bare, and cold was his initial and most lasting impression, on May 20, 1950, unceremoniously huddled with Clegg and Scarden in the back of a darkened police van. Clegg, fearing that the British newspapers would churn out disparaging stories about how the FBI had come to beat the truth out of Fuchs, and worse, that the clippings would make their way back to the director, had insisted on this covert transport in his opening meeting with the British spymasters. MI5 thought such subterfuge excessive, but ultimately, in the interest of keeping the Atlantic Partnership floating tranquilly along, acquiesced. So Clegg fired his next shot, and once more British eyebrows were swiftly raised. He announced the interrogation would proceed right away, tomorrow. The deputy director of MI5 gingerly explained that wouldn't be possible. The next morning was a Saturday, as well as the start of the Whitsun holiday weekend. Once again, Clegg remained adamant. He was used to getting his way, unless, of course, the conversation was with Hoover or Tolson. Early Saturday morning, the police van drove through one, then another, of the prison's huge gates, came to a sudden halt, and the trio climbed out. They were escorted by the warden to a room near the entrance. "The solicitor's room," he explained. And from the earnest way the warden spoke the words, Bob had the impression he was being led to a history-steeped, wood-paneled chamber, a clubby retreat for the well-spoken, frock-coated British lawyers who inhabited his imagination. The room was not much bigger than a prison cell, and just as grim. There were two narrow windows, little more than slits, that looked out on the sunless exercise yard, and a small glass panel in the door that offered a view of an officer on constant guard. The walls had once been gray, but the ancient paint had faded to the color of a lingering fog. A round table, surrounded by a circle of metal chairs, dominated the room. And it was cold, nearly the end of May, but Bob felt chilled to the bone. Then Fuchs was brought in. Like an affable host, Scarden made the introductions, and as he did, Bob took measure of his adversary. Fuchs looked, he'd say, as he'd expected from the photographs he'd studied. Thin-faced, intelligent, and colorless. He was 39, only 7 years older than Bob, but the FBI man felt there could be decades, no, centuries, separating him from the stoop-shouldered, sallow-faced, balding figure he faced. Imprisonment had aged the scientist and left him, Bob judged, vulnerable. But Bob sensed something else in Fuchs's hard stare, a determination to disguise the fears that raced inside him. Fuchs was well aware he had already lost, but he would refuse to surrender. In defeat, his last resort would be defiance. They sat around the table, like players settling in for a game of cards. Clegg had a pen in his hand and a pad in front of him. Scarden fussily loaded his pipe, and Fuchs had his hands folded like a man in prayer. They waited for Bob to begin. Fuchs, though, had the first words. He had clearly spent some time in his cell preparing his small speech, and it was made with precision, each word bristling with hostility. He did not, he said emphatically, have a legal obligation to answer any questions from the FBI. Therefore, he wanted some guarantees before he, again the forceful emphasis, decided whether or not to be interviewed. He wanted assurances that nothing would happen to any of the people with whom he'd been associated in the United States. Fuchs kept his scowling gaze fixed on the two FBI men, but Bob pretended to be unaware of this, and rather than push back, Bob chose to tread lightly. "I'm afraid you don't understand the function of the FBI," he explained in his most reasonable voice. "The Bureau simply conducts investigations, not prosecutions. Only a judge or an attorney general could make a promise not to bring a suspect to trial," he said, hoping to put an end to the matter. Fuchs ignored this disclaimer, and his voice once again rose in indignant anger. A vein that angled up from his eyebrow to his temple throbbed as he spoke. This time he was more direct, revealing what was provoking his hard-line stance. He was concerned about the safety of his sister. He wanted assurances that Crystal Heineman would not be prosecuted. Bob listened, and as he did, Fuchs's unspoken words were coming through as loudly as the spoken ones. Fuchs, he now grasped, was racked with guilt. Bob was not naive enough to think that the scientist, a true believer, had any regrets about his treason. The West, in his acid assessment, remained bloated, vulgar, and bellicose. Yet locked away in his dismal cell, the prisoner had lived each day and every long night with a torturous fear that his beloved sister, already sickly, would be punished for his crimes. From Fuchs's perspective, Bob imagined, in a sudden burst of empathy, it would be logical to assume the FBI must be cut from the same authoritarian cloth as the Gestapo or the Soviet secret police. Fuchs's tormented mind would have no trouble conjuring up images of jackbooted FBI agents carting a screaming, straitjacketed Crystal off without trial to a detention facility for re-education, or worse. After Fuchs had made his demand, a ponderous silence settled in. He cast a questionable glance toward Bob, waiting for him to respond, but Bob refused to acknowledge it. Time, Bob knew, was on his side. He wanted Fuchs to feel the mounting pressure. Everything, the success or failure of the entire interrogation, Bob intuited, depended on his next move. He could track up the high road, explain to Fuchs, in his considerate, calm government servant's voice, that America was not Nazi Germany. Innocent people were not carted off. Sisters do not pay for a brother's sins. Or he could exploit Fuchs's fears. In the end, Bob decided that since Fuchs had offered him the stick, he would use it. "I was not above letting Fuchs conclude that if we were the bastards he posited us to be, Crystal would continue to be in jeopardy," he recalled, still unrepentant years later. "We knew where Crystal was and would continue to keep tabs on her," Bob recalled warning Fuchs. But after the stick came the carrot. "He had no reason to believe," Bob went on, "that Crystal had any involvement with Fuchs's espionage in the United States other than the fact she had been contacted by Raymond. I do not regard this contact as significant," Bob said. Yet his implication was clear. The meetings between Crystal and Raymond could become significant if Fuchs refused to cooperate. With the tacit bargain dangling in the air, time was no longer on Bob's side. He needed Fuchs to make up his mind before the scientist could begin to speculate on whether the FBI's implied threat was a bluff. He wanted Fuchs to commit now. Moving quickly, Bob laid out a dozen photos across the table. Some were headshots of men previously suspected to be Raymond. Others were old photos of gold from the Bureau's files. And three were recent snaps of gold. On Bob's train ride from Washington to New York, two Bureau agents had boarded in Philadelphia with a surveillance movie of gold shot through the window of a parked car. The photos had been made from the film. "Do you recognize Raymond?" Bob asked. In every interrogation, there's a moment when all the bets have been placed and the wheel starts spinning. When the decision is made to cooperate or to refuse. A bolt of anticipation shot through Bob's chest as he waited to see what Fuchs would do. With a swipe of his long, thin fingers, Fuchs pushed one of the photographs dismissively aside, and Bob nearly let out a sigh of relief. One after another, he dismissed all the other stills except for the three recent surveillance images of gold. Fuchs studied them with concentration. "I cannot reject them," he told Bob finally, which Bob silently rejoiced was an improvement, however guarded, over the scientist's definitive rejection of the photograph of gold the British had shared with him. Nevertheless, the photos were not clear enough for him to state unequivocally that they were of the man he knew as Raymond. But now Bob had Fuchs talking, and in time, as Bob searched the spy's memory in the hope of supplementing the hazy portrait the Bureau had of Raymond, Fuchs shared the operational history of his meets with the KGB courier. January 15, 1944, 4 p.m. With numbers, Fuchs was always precise. A winter's Saturday on a street on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, as a concealing twilight settled over the city. Fuchs stood in front of the entrance to the Henry Street Settlement House. As instructed by his handler before he'd left London with the contingent of British physicists, he had a green book in one hand, a tennis ball grasped in the other. He waited for a man wearing gloves, yet who would also be holding an additional solitary glove. Raymond, a glove in his gloved hand, approached. Keeping to the prearranged word code, he asked directions to Chinatown. "I think Chinatown closes at 5 p.m., Fuchs replied, reciting his line of the script. Raymond hailed a cab, and they took it north to Manny Wolf's, a restaurant in the East 50s. They did not speak much during the meal, the spy and the handler apparently sizing each other up. Afterward, they walked toward the East River. It was cold and dark, and the sidewalks were nearly empty. Fuchs explained that he was working on the construction of an atomic device for the U.S. Army. He said it would be the most powerful weapon ever made. It would change history. He would bring reports on his work at their next meet. In 2 weeks, Raymond suggested. That was how it all began. On Monday, though, Bob was back in the present, and the Wormwood Scrubs solicitor's room had been transformed into a screening room. Blackout curtains covered the narrow windows that faced the yard, and another piece of dark cloth had been stretched across the door's glass panel. A boxy screen had been placed at one end of the room, and just beyond the table, John Simperman, the embassy liaison, stood by a projector. On Bob's command, the film started rolling. It was the Watchers film that had been shot only days before in Philadelphia. There was little action and even less plot. Just Gold, a short, dumpy, stooped figure, walking down a city street in his desultory, shambling way, then suddenly coming to an abrupt halt, as if he'd remembered something, until, apparently satisfied, continuing on with his journey.
"I cannot be absolutely positive,"
Fuchs announced as the lights came back on. But I think it is very likely him. There are certain mannerisms I seem to recognize. But after having spoken, Fuchs amended his initial impression. There was something about the man in the film that didn't seem to fit with his memories of Raymond. You must understand, he added, as if making a small apology for his indecision. It had been 5 years since he'd seen his American contact. Run it again, Bob ordered. When it was over, Fuchs decided he knew what was holding him back from providing a firm identification. There was something about the man's manner that wasn't quite right. In the film, he was serious. The Raymond he had known was jovial, bombastic, as if pleased with the importance of his assignment. Run it again, Bob ordered, doing his best to rein in his building impatience. This time, though, he had Simperman position the projector near the rear wall, increasing the distance from the screen and thus enlarging the image. As the movie rolled, Bob focused his attention on Fuchs. The physicist was an impassive audience. His face revealed nothing. When the lights came back on, Fuchs hesitated. Then he offered his judgment. Very likely, he decreed. Which Bob, his stomach sinking, knew was very likely not good enough to get an arrest warrant issued for Harry Gold, nor very likely to be sufficient to appease the director. Stymied in the present, Bob once again explored the past with Fuchs. February 16, 1945. Winter in Massachusetts. Piles of snow on the ground when Raymond arrived at the Heineman home. The courier had purchased a book he thought Crystal would enjoy, a novel about the relationship that develops between a black and a white family. For the Heineman children he brought candy. As a father of twins, a boy and a girl, he told the Heinemans, he knew what they'd liked. But this was more cover. Raymond had no children, nor was he married to the department store model wife he bragged about. Fuchs was waiting for him in the living room. Crystal soon left to pick up the children from school, and the spy and his guest went upstairs to talk in private. They sat in a room facing a snowy street, a weak wintry sun shining through a window flanked by parted curtains. The scientist had recently returned from Los Alamos, and he had brought with him what he described as a quite considerable packet of information. It was a primer for building a plutonium bomb. The two men agreed to see each other again in early June, this time in New Mexico, near the top-secret nuclear research compound. Fuchs gave Raymond a folded map. At the top of one side were the words, Santa Fe, the capital city in the land of enchantment. The scientist opened the map, spread it out on the bed, and pointed to where he wanted to meet. 4 o'clock on the first Saturday in June, Raymond agreed. Without warning, one of the Heineman children poked his head into the room. They had just returned from school. Raymond said he'd better go, folding the map quickly as he talked and then putting it into his pocket. But after Crystal came upstairs and shooed the curious boy from the room, Raymond was no longer in a rush. He announced there was something else. He had a Christmas present for Fuchs, a gift from Moscow Center. It was a wallet, very thin, the sort that might be used on an occasion that called for formal dress. Fuchs accepted it, looking at it with more bewilderment than gratitude. Raymond said that the center had also provided something to go along with the wallet. The courier handed his agent an envelope containing $1,500, a munificent sum. Fuchs's face distorted as if he had just experienced an unpleasant smell. Insulted, he returned the envelope to Raymond. He was not assisting the Soviet Union for his own personal gain, he said with a stony contempt. Raymond was suddenly in a hurry to leave. Leaving the prison after that second long day, Bob and Clegg went directly to Simperman's office in the embassy. Each night they had to cable the results of the day's session to Bureau headquarters, attention the director. First they would write their report, and then they would use a one-time pad to encipher it. As they worked, Bob couldn't help remembering that it was the failure to employ a one-time pad correctly, as well as Meredith's genius, that had allowed him to bring the entire operation this far, to the threshold of uncovering the identity of the courier for a Soviet atomic spy. But at the same time he knew that the length of the operational road he had traveled would not be any consolation to the unforgiving Hoover. Fuchs had not definitively identified Raymond, and Bob therefore had not accomplished his mission. Bob handed the encoded cable to the clerk in the embassy code room for priority dispatch to Washington, feeling that with its transmission, his career, as well as his opportunity to bring about the downfall of a ring of spies, was doomed. 30. Still, it was a war fought on several fronts, so even while Bob's spirits sank in London, across the Atlantic, in Philadelphia, the Bureau's troops moved forward. Shortly after 8 a.m. Philadelphia time, on the same Monday as the inconclusive screening at Wormwood Scrubs, two agents knocked on the front door of Harry Gold's home. The appointment had been amicably arranged days earlier. On May 17th, the two agents, Scotty Miller, who by chance was Bob's happy-go-lucky buddy from their days together on the SE squad in New York, and Richard Brennan, a hulking, saturnine veteran, there teaming in line with the classic good cop, bad cop tandem the Bureau relished, spent an exhaustive 9 hours interviewing Gold. Throughout that marathon session in the Philadelphia field office, both the interrogators and their subject had done their best to project a genial goodwill toward one another. The FBI men conveyed that they were embarrassed by their assignment, just underlings going through the motions to appease their bosses in what they knew would ultimately prove to be a pointless fishing expedition. Gold was magnanimous and composed. A man of the world, he knew too well about wrong-headed bosses, his helpful demeanor suggested. Ask whatever you like, he had nothing to hide. And no, he didn't need a lawyer. Only guilty people need lawyers. Yet it had all been an act. As the lengthy interview ground on and on, all the players had been determined to give the performances of their lives. The FBI agents were treading lightly because they had nothing substantive to throw at Gold. Their fear was that if they followed their every instinct and attacked, then the chemist would lawyer up, and they'd never get the chance to wangle an incriminating admission out of him. As for Gold, whose heart was thumping violently the whole tense time, he wanted to believe that his cooperation, supplemented by his silent prayers, would result in all of the Bureau's suspicions fading away. But he didn't trust them, and he knew they didn't trust him. Gold, however, was trapped. The chemist felt as if he had no choice but to take everything the two smiling agents said at face value. So, when they asked for handwriting samples, he cordially wrote out page after page. When they asked if he'd mind if they shot some motion picture footage, he said why not, and found the calm to make a joke about how this screen test could land him a whole new career. And when they asked if they could search his house, he didn't make some snarky comment like, "Sure, if you have a warrant." Instead, he suggested they come by the following Monday, when he knew his father and brother, with whom he lived, would not be home. Absolutely no point in inconveniencing them, the agents concurred brightly. See you at 8. Gold had planned to spend the weekend gathering up any hints of his clandestine activities that he might have carelessly left lying about. But he never got around to it. He told himself that he didn't want to explain an unprecedented flurry of housekeeping to his brother and father. They'd only grow anxious. But on some deeper, unarticulated level, Gold understood that his procrastination was illogical, perhaps even a wishful attempt to deny the existence of the sword poised above his exposed neck. At 5 a.m. on Monday, May 22nd, however, Gold rose from his bed after a restless night and realized he'd better do something. He started looking about for incriminating traces of his secret life and was quickly, he'd later say, horrified. The enormity of his mistake became apparent. Everywhere he looked, or so it suddenly seemed in the mad panic that swept over him in the first bright light of the spring dawn, another clue was revealed. The stub of a plane ticket from Albuquerque to Kansas City. The draft of a report on a meeting with Rest in Cambridge. A street map of Dayton, Ohio. Instructions from his control. There was so much material. What had he been thinking? But calling upon the self-protectiveness that every spy learns if he is to survive in his dangerous life, he understood this was not the time for self-recriminations. With manic energy, he hurled himself about, racing from room to room, gathering handful after handful of incriminating papers. He ripped them into pieces, shredded the pieces with his determined hands, and then watched them swirl away as he flushed the traces down the toilet. "Yes, I had taken care of everything," he recalled, rejoicing. And when the knock came promptly at 8, as promised, he had regained all his prior ease. He opened the door, flashed the agents an ingratiating smile, and showed them in as hospitably as if they'd merely stopped by for a morning's cup of coffee. But Miller and Brennan were acting from a different script than the one they had followed on Friday. Before leaving the field office earlier that morning, they had been informed of Supervisor Lamphere's failure to get Fuchs to confirm definitively that Gold was the agent codenamed Raymond. That meant, they had also been advised, the success of the investigation could very well depend on them. And with that knowledge, both agents also felt the sharp edge of a warning. When the two men headed out, they agreed that their pretense of affability had run its course. They would conduct their search with a strict and brisk professionalism. They cut off Gold's cheery questions about their weekend, ignored his offer of breakfast, and proceeded to his bedroom. Rows of books lined the shelves of a tall bookcase, chemical manuals, math and physics textbooks, stray volumes that had been acquired in a lifetime of reading. They attacked them all, riffling through one book after another with a meticulousness that left Gold appalled and suddenly very frightened. "What is this?" challenged Brennan. He had a paperback copy of Microbe Hunters and was pointing to a small tag on the inside cover. "Shibby, Kerr, and Lindsay." "Oh, I don't know," Gold answered. "I must have picked it up on a used book counter somewhere." While in the same instant his memory sharply brought it all back into focus. An impetuous purchase at a Rochester, New York store as he killed time before making his way to a meet. Then Miller spoke up. He held a 1945 train schedule, Washington, Philadelphia, New York, Boston, Montreal. "How about this?" the agent asked. "Goodness knows," said Gold. A pensive beat, and then he added, as if its significance had just become clear, "I probably got it when I went to New York to see Brothman." But he had known the moment Miller had waved it about. He had consulted the schedule on one of his trips to see the Heinemans. The agents continued their search, and as 1 hour passed, and then another, Gold's confidence returned. He had fielded their questions. They had found nothing he couldn't explain away, and they would soon be done. He was going to survive. He would not be exposed. Brennan had a heavy textbook in his hand, The Principles of Chemical Engineering, and he was going methodically through it when he noticed something stuck between the pages. It was a folded street map for the city of Santa Fe. The agent removed the map and began to study it with considerable attention. "How had I missed that?" Gold asked himself in silent reproach. He had been looking specifically for this map earlier that morning, but when he couldn't find it, he'd decided it must have been discarded long ago. "You forgot you had this, didn't you, Harry?" Brennan said. The taunt of triumph in his voice was unmistakable. "My God, where did that come from?" Gold tried. But for the first time the agent saw the chemist's alarm. They waited as a heavy silence filled the room.
"I don't know how that thing got in there," Gold said at last.
But of course he did. Raymond was early. The meet had been scheduled for 4 on this Saturday afternoon, June 2, 1945, and the bus had pulled into Santa Fe hours earlier. He did not think surveillance would be a problem, but being a conscientious professional, he kept to his cover and, like any tourist, went to the city's historical museum. He tried to show interest in the exhibits, only his nerves were all over the place. He got that way before every rendezvous. At the gift shop he picked up a map, and it was identical to the one Fuchs had given him in Cambridge, a giveaway issued by the Chamber of Commerce. With the map as his guide, he arrived at the appointed spot precisely on time. The Castillo Street Bridge arched over the Santa Fe River like a small frown. It was a lonely, isolated spot, and the longer Raymond waited, the more he grew convinced that Fuchs's trade graft was faulty. He felt very exposed standing on the bridge. There was no logical reason for him to be there if he were questioned. He kept looking at his watch, wondering if Fuchs would show, if he should abort the mission. Fuchs at last drove up in his gray Buick, rolled down the window, and told the courier to get in. They drove across the bridge and continued on for a short while. Fuchs parked in a flat, sandy spot. Desert and cactus stretched out toward the horizon. They talked for about 30 minutes. The physicist reported that everyone at Los Alamos was working hard almost night and day. The bomb, he said, would be completed soon enough to be used against the Japanese. Fuchs handed the courier a thick package, and at the same time emphasized the importance of this delivery. It contained a sketch of the atomic bomb itself. It was a diagram of the device that would be tested within weeks at Alamogordo in the New Mexico desert. The weapon's dimensions, components, core, and initiator were all precisely indicated. With the information in this package, Fuchs believed, Russian scientists would be able to manufacture their own bomb. The momentous package held tightly in his hand, Raymond left the car. He began the long, dusty walk back to town, hoping he could find his way in time to catch the next bus to Albuquerque.
"I thought you said you'd never been out west," Miller objected.
"Give me a minute," Gold said.
Miller rose from the chair where he'd been sitting, and absently Gold took his place. He sank down into it, diminished. He asked for a cigarette, although he didn't like to smoke. He just wanted to do something other than answer the question. All the while, Gold's thoughts were churning rapidly. The map of Santa Fe, he told himself, wasn't in itself too incriminating. He could talk his way out of this. But what if Fuchs identified him? And the Heinemanns? And Brothman revealed all he knew? He had piled lie upon lie, and as soon as the FBI knocked one loose, the entire structure would come tumbling down. At that unsteady moment, as Brennan stood across from him with the map in his hand, Gold finally grasped the inevitability of his exposure.
Yes, I am the man to whom Klaus Fuchs gave the information on atomic energy, Gold said. The words a soft, doleful surrender.
Raymond had been found, but Hoover was still not satisfied. He had sent Lamphere over to London not just to get Fuchs to identify the courier, but also to demonstrate that the Bureau, his vaunted creation, could accomplish what the British, what any other law enforcement agency for that matter, could not. Only the FBI could get a Moscow Center spy to crack. And if events had moved too swiftly to allow that prideful point to be made to the world, Hoover was determined to manipulate history until it unfolded to his liking. Gold had confessed at 10:15 on Monday morning, but his arraignment was deliberately postponed for 2 days. Hoover hoped it would be enough time for reality to catch up to his version of the truth. While a forlorn Gold sat in custody in Philadelphia, Al Belmont scurried about headquarters making sure that new still photos and motion pictures of the chemist were shot and sent by special air courier to London. And he sent a flash cable to Bob and Clegg, along with sharing the still-secret news that Gold had signed a written confession. He ordered them to keep their next session going as long as possible without interruption. The implicit message was clear. It was now more important than ever to get Fuchs to identify Gold. Bob went into the session on May 23rd with the resolve of a man who knew he would be making a last stand. He had not told Fuchs about Gold's confession, just as he had not previously revealed that the chemist was the Bureau's primary suspect. His only operational advantage was the newly arrived still photographs and the motion picture footage. The photos were not surveillance shots, but clear, crisp images taken under good lighting. They reminded Bob of the portraits from his high school yearbook. He wanted very much to believe they would resolve Fuchs's small but lingering doubts. As the blackout curtains were being draped over the windows and the film was being threaded into the projector, Bob took an impetuous gamble. He laid the new photographs on the table in a neat row. Fuchs needed only a quick look.
"Yes," he said. "That is my American contact."
Clegg hurried out of the room, eager to get a cable off to the Bureau. The next day, May 24th, when Fuchs's arraignment was reported in the New York Times, the headline spread across the front page announced, "Philadelphian seized as spy on the basis of data from Fuchs." Hoover could at last enjoy his triumph. Bob, too, was lifted out of the doldrums.
"The director had charged us to find Fuchs's American contact, and we had fulfilled that assignment," he recalled, still relishing his accomplishment.
2 days later, he passed the still photographs of Harry Gold to Fuchs, along with a pen. He watched as the man he had once known only as Rest turned the photos over and began writing on the back, on one photo after another, "I identify this photograph as the likeness of the man whom I knew under the name of Raymond. Klaus Fuchs, 26th May 1950. At that moment, Bob would say, without embarrassment, "an unbelievably great weight seemed to lift from my shoulders."
31. The six-story white brick building on Peschanya Street in Moscow had been built by German prisoners of war, and so it was nearly new when Sasha and his wife and young daughter moved in shortly after his return from London in April 1950. They shared rooms in a communal apartment, but it was with only one other family. The space felt luxurious. During his postings to New York and London, the family's belongings had been scattered among many relatives for safekeeping. Back, at last, in Moscow, it was comfortable to be able to gather all their possessions in their own home. The center assigned him to the British section, part of the KGB's first chief directorate for foreign intelligence. The spymasters were grooming Sasha for bigger things, and they wanted to keep an eye on him, curious to see if, as a desk man, he would live up to the promise he'd shown in the field. His old friend Yatskov had also returned to Moscow, still part of the 10th Department, Science and Technology. They would meet from time to time for a drink. After the intensity of their long days at the center orchestrating complex and fitful covert plots around the world, the two friends needed to unwind before returning home to their families. One evening, a few days after Victory Day, May 10, 1950, Sasha peered into Yatskov's office, hoping to suggest a drink. His friend looked, he'd remember, drawn, his eyes lifeless.
"Do you have a minute?" Yatskov asked.
Sasha took a seat, but rather than start right in, Yatskov pulled himself up from his desk and closed the door. The unusual precaution took Sasha by surprise, and he had a sudden sense of dread.
"We have a traitor in our American networks," Yatskov said after he had returned to his desk.
Sasha waited to hear more, but the sickness in his stomach had already started.
"It's Gold, that strange bird," he announced.
The words were a small attempt at gallows humor. The Russian word for goose, gus, was Gold's code name. Neither of the friends, though, could manage a laugh. The Americans were still looking for Raymond, but Yatskov, full of a gloomy certainty, explained that he had no doubt that with Fuchs in custody they would eventually find the courier. And when pressure was applied to Gold, he was sure to break. He'd reveal all he knew about the American networks. They left for their drink, telling each other that it was still possible the enemy would never find Raymond. But that night, a beautiful May evening, both men got very drunk. 2 weeks later, on May 24th, when the ominous news spread through the center that the FBI had arrested Harry Gold, Sasha had to admit to himself that his friend's prediction would come true. "Disaster," he acknowledged, "is now at hand." The next day there was, Sasha heard, a series of quickly convened meetings, where one spymaster after another spoke up, each saying something had to be done to save our agents in America. But all the sessions ended with the same head-hanging realization. There was little that could be done. At this point it was too late to make the complicated arrangements that would be necessary to get them out of the country. And if the center's escape plans failed, if the FBI caught the fleeing agents as they were furtively attempting to make their way behind the Iron Curtain, it would immediately establish their guilt and reinforce the validity of the enemy's accusations. Worse, it would compound the KGB's visible failures. It was agreed. All the Kremlin would do was offer vehement, outraged denials if the Americans charged their agents with espionage. In the days that followed, the mood in the center grew more upbeat. Any fatalistic thinking, the spymasters confidently insisted, was precipitous, even unwarranted. The FBI was a collection of clumsy farmhands. They would never succeed in breaking our networks. Yet Sasha was not so reassured. He foresaw the future with a woeful prescience. When dominoes are lined up, he knew, the first one to fall draws all the others with it. 32. As Bob, determined to be the courteous American guest, made his farewells in London, a mischievous gift of nylons to the MI5 link man's pretty wife, a pipe purchased on Regent Street for the helpful Scarden, the Bureau in these first days of June was already on full battle footing. The once sleepy SE squads, agents formerly resigned to tracking Soviet officials from a discreet distance, had become headhunters. The bagging of a Soviet atom spy and his courier had left the men in the field excited by the prospect of what might lie ahead. They all wanted a piece of the looming counterintelligence prize. Yet despite these high hopes, the dampening reality was that in the 2 weeks that followed Gold's arrest, his interrogations had yielded a thin product, its promise more tantalizing than its operational value. In weepy soliloquies to his court-appointed attorneys, the chemist remained determined not to turn rat, to be a squealer. There were boundaries he refused to cross. In response, the Bureau ratcheted up the pressure. From his desk at headquarters, Al Belmont issued stern instructions. He cabled the interrogators in Philadelphia that Gold was to be exhaustively interviewed for all the information in his possession. Belmont had his heart set on the pot of gold that he knew was waiting at the end of the rainbow, the descriptions of his contacts in the espionage field. "Bring me," he ordered, "the names of other persons engaged in espionage at Los Alamos or at any other locations." The Bureau had finally come around to Bob's way of looking at the world. It was riddled with active Soviet spies. After 2 weeks of being subjected to almost daily interrogations, Gold's obstinacy proved no match for the agent's persistence. As the Bureau's inquisitors kept flaying away at him with sharp questions, his resolve staggered. He realized there was no choice but to accept the harsh terms of his unalterable fate. Yet still trying to cling to a small measure of honor, Gold broke not with a bang, but with a series of whimpers. He doled out his betrayals of the networks he'd served, one laconic revelation at a time. As Scotty Miller, who had led the team trolling for his secrets, complained, "Interviewing Gold was like squeezing a lemon. There was always a drop or two left." Nevertheless, when Bob returned to headquarters in early June, he found a bounty of gifts welcoming him home. "Cases developed from the confession of Harry Gold were breaking everywhere, dozens of them every day," he recalled. And with this sudden frenzy of activity, the constant flurry of priority teletypes from the field offices as they pursued one lead after another, normal business hours and 5-day weeks replaced by a nearly round-the-clock commitment, Bob at last had the enemy's secret armies arrayed in his line of fire. Over the past year he had rambled on to Meredith in a largely abstract way about the big picture, his code for the enemy's master plan. But this would be his long-anticipated opportunity to shove the KGB's picture out of focus. "We would continue to race ahead to the point where we would be able to arrest whole KGB networks." And, making his return home even sweeter, the fifth floor, formalizing what had long been the reality, christened him administrative director of the whole operation. Bob was in command. Gold only had to offer up a name, and Bob's troops fanned out to take the enemy agent down. The chemist, for example, had started out in his hedging way referring to an agent he had serviced, codenamed Martin. 7 meets over a series of years, in locations from Rochester, New York, to Oak Ridge, Tennessee. The yield was a wealth of industrial secrets. The best material involved the manufacture of explosives. But now Gold's hesitancy slipped away, and he added an identity to that KGB codename. Alfred Dean Slack. Soon enough, Slack was in custody, telling the Bureau all he knew, and providing more fruitful leads in the process. Next, Gold turned on an old friend, Thomas Black, identifying him as the Soviet asset who had recruited him for the KGB back in 1936. And now that they had Gold talking, the Bureau, still bitter about the lies that had allowed Abe Brofman to walk away unscathed, sicked the chemist on his old business associate. Gold spilled all he knew, and the Bureau now had the goods to make a perjury case against both Brofman and his longtime girlfriend, Miriam Moskowitz. The dominoes, as Sasha had dolefully predicted, were indeed starting to fall. But as he sent his agents scurrying off in all directions, Bob's mind was elsewhere. A small piece of intelligence Gold had revealed to the interrogators kept bothering him, the proverbial pebble in the shoe that made its presence felt with each new step. On its surface, the courier's account of his meet in Los Alamos jibed with what Fuchs had told him in their sessions in Wormwood Scrubs. Even the date matched. Nevertheless, there was something that left him troubled, something that didn't seem quite right about Gold's version of the June rendezvous with the physicist on the Castillo Street Bridge. Only Bob couldn't quite put his finger on it. Mystified, he picked up the interrogation transcript and began to reread the relevant section. "I traveled to Albuquerque on this first meeting via train to Chicago, then by train to Albuquerque, and finally by bus to Santa Fe. My meeting with Dr. Fuchs was on Saturday afternoon. Then I returned from Santa Fe to Albuquerque by bus that same day. As I recall, I slept in the hallway of a rooming house where those who were unable to obtain local hotel accommodations were bedded." Bob went over the section one more time, still suspicious, yet still baffled. And then all of a sudden he was shouting at his clerks, telling him to bring him bus and train schedules. He wanted to see if there was a more direct route from Chicago to Santa Fe, one that wouldn't have required the courier to pass through Albuquerque. It did not take Bob long to establish that there was a train that went straight to Santa Fe. There was no apparent reason to stop at Albuquerque. With that clear in his mind, when Bob went back to Gold's statement still one more time, the connection was made. The courier had not only traveled through Albuquerque, but he'd stayed the night. Gold couldn't get a hotel room, yet he still had spent a night in Albuquerque. Why? Bob thought he knew, but he needed Gold to say it. When the interrogators put the question to Gold, he understood at once that they were on to him. Cornered, he swiftly conceded defeat. He shared what he had been holding back. Yes, he'd had a meet in Albuquerque. Gold told the story haltingly and with few specifics, but he insisted it was his memory's fault. He was trying to cooperate. As he was preparing for his meet with Fuchs in Santa Fe, he'd been summoned to New York by his Soviet control. There he was given an additional assignment. He was to make a second pickup on his trip out west. His control gave Gold a piece of cardboard torn from a Jell-O box. The agent would have the matching piece. If the fragments fit together, he was to proceed with the pickup. In Albuquerque, Gold went to a private house, and the recognition signal was exchanged. He couldn't remember the address or the agent's name. The best he could offer was that the agent was a U.S. Army man, non-commissioned, married, the wife's name may have been Ruth, and they both had New York accents. The soldier gave him some handwritten pages and a sketch. They concerned the atomic bomb. He suspected the soldier was a technician, someone with a scientific background. They talked of a future meeting in New York, where the soldier would deliver more material. Gold handed him $500, which the soldier accepted, and then Gold left. Bob read the interrogator's thin report, and he knew with a reinforced certainty what he had known all along. Meredith had been right. A possible link between Enormos and wartime nuclear fission research. There was another Soviet spy at Los Alamos, just as Meredith had also told him. February 1950. A gray and chilly winter's day in Washington. Bob's memory, unlike Gold's, remained clear. A quick mental transition, and Bob found himself back in that heady, fast-moving time. Meredith, working brutal hours, was making discoveries almost daily, and nearly as rapidly his previous theories were being revised as the more recent decodings dictated. The search for truth, Meredith repeatedly lectured his friend with dogmatic pedantry, was a constant search for better hypotheses. And now, once again, that frigid day summoned up in his thoughts, Bob was making the bone-chilling walk across the base's campus, and there was Meredith pouncing on him before he had a chance to make his way to the office's rattling